This is Jane Poulin and Jeff Smith at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission interviewing Scott Taub. And Scott, you're familiar with the FCIC and that we are mandated to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. It's a temporary special committee established by law in 2009, and we will be issuing a report December 15th, 2010. We're on this call to discuss most specifically accounting and its role during the financial crisis, but if you have other thoughts as we go along, we'd be happy to pick up those thoughts as well. And Scott, if you could just briefly, for the record, give us your background. I think go back to kind of your college education and then a summary of your history since then. That'd be great.
Okay, very good. I graduated University of Michigan 1990 with a degree in economics. Started work shortly thereafter as an auditor with Arthur Andersen in its Detroit office. I spent 7 years as an auditor before moving to Arthur Andersen's headquarters in Chicago as part of the Professional Standards Group. Professional Standards Group at Arthur Andersen was the group responsible for formulating and disseminating Arthur Andersen's positions on accounting and auditing technical issues, as well as interfacing with accounting standard setters, regulators, and other relevant bodies. In 1999, I joined the Securities and Exchange Commission as a professional accounting fellow in the Office of the Chief Accountant for 2 years. While there, I worked on a variety of matters that arose with regards to public company application of accounting standards, and also worked on oversight of accounting and auditing standard centers. I rejoined Arthur Andersen in 2001 as a partner in the Professional Standards Group. When Arthur Andersen blew up a year later, I rejoined the SEC as a deputy chief accountant in the Office of the Chief Accountant. I spent 4.5 years as deputy chief accountant. For about 1.5 years of that time, I was also acting chief accountant. During that time, at the as deputy chief and acting chief, I had responsibility for the final call within the commission on the application of accounting standards, was responsible for the commission's oversight of the FASB, IASB, and other accounting standard setters. Also was involved in the SEC's review of auditor independence issues, audit performance, and was part of the SEC's senior leadership and therefore was involved in some of the other policy decisions reached by the SEC. I left the SEC in January of 2007, and I have since then been part of a consulting firm called Financial Reporting Advisors. Financial Reporting Advisors consults with generally public companies, but also private companies as well, on their more difficult accounting and financial reporting matters. We also do some expert work in terms of writing expert reports, consulting on litigation matters, purchase price disputes, and also expert testimony on accounting and financial reporting matters.
Okay. Great. Thanks, Scott. That was great background. So from your perspective, either firsthand or just as an observer during the financial crisis, do you have any observations about kind of the role of accounting? Either there are certain areas of accounting that other participants in the marketplace have alleged contributed or caused the financial crisis, exacerbated the financial crisis, or alternatively, are there areas of accounting that were kind of highlighted because of the financial crisis, either because the accounting performed well or didn't perform well, during the financial crisis. So,
okay. Broad question. I have done some thinking about this in the past. I would say that there actually were some accounting standards that facilitated the transactions that were at the heart of the crisis. Many people have blamed fair value accounting for either causing or exacerbating the crisis. I think that's completely off base. If anything, greater use of fair value accounting helped expose the problems sooner. It certainly didn't cause them. But the accounting standards related to securitization transactions in FAS 140, FASB Statement Number 140, in my view, were specifically crafted in a way to permit what was perceived as advantageous accounting for certain kinds of securitization transactions. And those accounting standards were both used and abused by some of the institutions engaging in securitization transactions. It's clear to me that had the accounting standards been different, had off-balance sheet accounting for securitizations been harder to achieve, there would have been less securitization activity. I don't know how much less. And I don't know whether it would have been a particularly troublesome securitization that didn't get done. But it is clear to me that those accounting standards facilitated the securitization activity that was at the heart of the crisis. Compounding that is the fact that for many companies, once the assets were off the books, they, to some extent, lost sight of the risks that they still had related to those assets. So even if they had done the securitization transaction, if the assets had still been on their books because they failed to get off-balance sheet accounting, I think we might have had better management of those risks and better knowledge of just where the risks lay.
Okay. Scott,
so
I
was happy to see that the updated FAS 140 with FAS 166 and 167, I'm not sure whether those are the greatest standards, but they're at least tighter than what was there in FAS 140. A little bit like, closing the barn door after the cow left, but at least we've got some better and tighter standards now.
Okay. Scott, this is an area of interest of mine as well. I want to get a little bit more detailed on your views.
Sure.
So on FAS 140 securitizations, I think in broadly in two buckets, QSPEs and non-QSPE securitizations.
Sure.
So when you speak of securitizations and that some, let me refer to sponsors, broadly, in the broadest sense of the term, are you referring to sponsors of QSPEs used and abused, potentially abused, or non-QSPEs, or do you make a distinction between those types of structures?
There is a distinction. Obviously, the standards made a distinction, and the QSPEs were used for certain purposes. Other SPEs were used for other securitization vehicles. It's abundantly clear that the concept of a QSPE was applied far different than it was originally intended.
Or said differently, if somebody that wasn't a securitization expert who came in, dropped in and looked at the types of structures that were qualifying, if you will, as QSPEs, they might not have immediately gotten the same conclusion?
I think that the problem is the FASB originally had a concept of QSBs as kind of a brain-dead pass-through entity.
Right.
Nobody has to think about the operations of the QSB because the money goes in, and then it goes out in a predetermined pattern. You know, that you can kind of have a computer running the company with an algorithm. And that's all you need.
Right. No management, no decision making.
That's right. That was the original concept of a QSPE. When the FASB finalized FAS 125 and then FAS 140, they offer up some explanations, rules, guidelines for how to know if you meet the definition of a QSPE. And those guidelines could be read very narrowly or could be read a little more broadly. And as is often the case in the accounting world, they were read more broadly to allow more things to be QSPEs. And over time, that bucket of things that could qualify as QSPEs was gradually expanded. We had a perfect example of that with what happened after Hurricane Katrina. After Hurricane Katrina, there were understandably a lot of people in the affected area, in the affected areas who were having trouble taking their mortgage payments. Many of those mortgages were owned by QSPEs. The sponsors of those the original issuers of the mortgages, who were now the sponsors of the QSPEs, started asking questions about whether, if they modified those loans in advance of a default because they wanted to make things easier on the borrower, whether that would destroy the status of the Q. They were very concerned about losing the off-balance sheet accounting. Two interesting things out of that. Number one, they weren't going to do the modifications if it was going to destroy the Q and bring the assets back on the books.
Well, would that also bring into question the previous sale accounting that had been achieved?
That was my second point.
Okay.
The from an accounting standpoint, the bigger issue that exposes the mere fact that the sponsors still had the power to modify the mortgages indicates they should never have been Qs in the first place.
Yeah,
but
right.
Every mortgage that was in a Q was in a Q where the sponsor still had that power.
Oh, so they weren't really questioning, you know, help us interpret whether we have the power. They were asserting they had the power. Help us understand whether this would blow up the queue.
There was no question they had the power, and they were wondering whether exercise of the power would blow up the queue, when actually the fact that they had the power in the first place should have meant that it wasn't a queue. But, you know, at that point, we were too far gone to actually enforce the view that the mere fact you have the power is a problem. That would have brought millions of mortgages back onto the books of banks.
Right.
Because all the queues were set up that way.
So, let me just...
Well, I think that even back then, this was, you know, 2005 or so, we already had very clear evidence that queues had gone way beyond what we thought they were for. And that was because, as illustrated by the fact that the banks weren't going to modify the mortgages if it meant bringing them back on the books, it's because off-balance sheet accounting was extremely important to them. And that's why I believe that if we'd had tighter accounting regulations surrounding securitizations, we wouldn't have had as much of this activity.
Mm-hmm. So definitely off-balance sheet accounting is important to them for a number of reasons. But also, do you think the fact that they could achieve upfront sale accounting?
Well, my sense is that it wasn't so much wanting to record upfront profit as it was getting the assets off the books. Because if the assets were on the books, they counted against them for regulatory capital purposes, risk-weighted capital, and all of these other regulatory measures.
Mm-hmm.
They could get them off the books. Well, then, you know, they move along.
Okay.
You know, for lots of reasons, bank regulators had tied their measures to GAAP accounting. I understand some of the reasons for that, but I think in a situation like this, it it really causes problems because the goals of GAAP, mm-hmm. preparing information for investment decisions, are different than the goals and needs of regulators.
Right. So if we take, for example, if we take the QSPEs, there is some recognition in the regulatory capital standards for off-balance sheet exposures. I suppose in the perfect world, if the exposure, which would in this case, if we take those Katrina-related mortgages and securitizations as an example, if the sponsor said, yes, I have these off-balance sheet vehicles and properly recognized that there was exposure relevant to those mortgages, then there would have been some nominal capital charge potentially, but they still have to assess the risk, and I don't know the capital requirements in extreme detail, but it seems as though one of the things they would factor in is what is the likelihood of a loss. So even if you look at the off-balance sheet vehicles when you considered the capital requirements and you considered the risks like we talked about for these Katrina mortgages, putting aside the fact that it causes an accounting issue, that they would probably have assessed that the risk of that type of event that would give rise to that risk actually resulting in a real loss event for them,
mm-hmm.
Would be low. So just the mere fact that these things are off balance sheet, even though there is some recognition in the capital requirements, leads to there being very little capital retained.
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
And ideally what you'd want is that if you took a given transaction, just look at the documents surrounding the securitization and the loans that are involved, I think you'd probably want the regulatory effect of that transaction to be exactly the same whether it achieved off-balance sheet accounting or not.
So, for example, if the risk weighting for a mortgage, if it were on balance sheet, is, I'm sure I have the percentages wrong, 50%, then you want the risk weight for the off-balance sheet mortgages to also be 50%, regardless of the fact that they're off-balance sheet.
Well, I think you'd want to take a look at the actual risks.
Right.
And the risks faced by the company are not changed by whether the mortgage is on or off the balance sheet. The company faces whatever risks it faces.
Right.
So, I think that I don't know enough about bank regulatory activities to actually suggest what could have or should have been changed. However, it strikes me that where you've got a safety and soundness regulator that's clearly concerned about risks, understandably so, and you have an accounting standard like FAS 140 that is based on control, not based on risks, you're likely to get some differences in terms of what may be the most relevant treatment for the two different purposes.
Right.
And so we had a situation where GAAP accounting affected regulatory measures, thus making it very important for the institutions to get off-balance sheet accounting for securitizations. Mm-hmm. And FAS 140 was specifically crafted to allow off-balance sheet accounting for certain kinds of transactions. And I think that in practice, it was used to allow off-balance sheet accounting for even more transactions than it was designed to allow.
Right. So eventually, over time, more things qualified as QSPEs than they did were intended, and probably more than qualified as QSPEs, say, day one after FAS 140 was issued.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And then, so now with 166 and 167, we no longer have Qs. We have a new model replacing FIN 46.
Right.
So Qs no longer exist. We have a new model. But before we go there, the non-QSPEs, that would fall in this either, well, I guess SPEs that would be subject to FIN 46R. Do you have any specific thoughts on the FIN 46R type SPEs?
Well, you know, the securitizations that were run through entities that didn't qualify as QSBs obviously achieved off-balance sheet accounting less frequently. That
it was
being said,
harder to get off-balance sheet accounting,
right?
Because you don't just have to fit the model, the structure of the QSBE. There's more to it.
That's right. But that being said, if you could achieve sale accounting, which was often the case, the institutions very quickly after FIN 46R came out figured out a way to not have to consolidate the entity by changing the structures to have somebody else invest in so-called first loss notes, for example, so that because FIN 46R had a purely mathematical approach to deciding who was the primary beneficiary, if anybody, you could divvy up the risks and rewards in such a way that the sponsor avoided consolidation.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw in a lot of commercial paper conduits that that's exactly what happened. Parmalat provided a wonderful example.
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because I've referred to that as an example of that should have made it clear to people that there was a problem.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And the Parmalat situation, the receivables were in an SPE. That SPE was not consolidated by the sponsor, but when there was a loss, the sponsor kicked in to cover the loss.
And the sponsor in this case was Citi? I've forgotten.
I think it was Citi. The facility that was tapped to cover the loss was a so-called liquidity facility, and the liquidity facilities had been ignored in the FIN 46R analysis because they were considered to be voluntary. The sponsor didn't have to come up with money through the liquidity facility in these kind of events. Yet they chose to, which suggests to me that it wasn't exactly voluntary, because I don't think that a company as smart as Citigroup volunteers to lose $200 million it doesn't have to lose. So, yes, I agree with you, Jane. I think that the Parmalat situation did show that the problems were not limited to QSBs. Now, whether the various structures at the heart of the financial crisis, all the various mortgage-backed securities, whether they came out of all Qs or a mix of Qs and non-Qs, I think probably depends on the deal. And
yeah,
of course, some of these securities were run through several SPEs during their lives.
Yeah, that's probably true. You're right. I hadn't really thought about that. Probably the mortgages originally went through a Q, and then they end up in a CDO, which is not a Q.
Exactly.
So the CDO blows up. Yeah. I haven't thought about those connections.
Stripping, you go through the QSBE and you issue some AA securities and then some lower tiers, and then you take the lower tiers, stick them in a CDO so that the top of the CDO can be more AA securities. It's a mix of things.
Mm-hmm. So if the CDO is having financial difficulties, it's ultimately because the underlying mortgages are having financial difficulties, but the underlying mortgages will still remain off balance sheet because they were in a queue.
That's right, and they weren't on anybody's balance sheet, and so I think that contributed to the fact that nobody was looking at them too hard. Everybody thought, I think, that the stuff not on their balance sheet must be of lower risk, and it turns out there was still a lot of risk there.
Yeah, well, I think most, the average user of financial statements may have a view that if it's not on the balance sheet, then I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to go to footnote 23 and read through pages and pages of disclosure about the off-balance sheet vehicles.
And to be fair, you know, it doesn't surprise me that, you know, mom-and-pop individual investor has that view. It surprises me that the institutions that were holding these mortgage-backed securities seemed to have that view.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time after things started to tank for people to figure out who was holding the bag. And you would have thought that the institutions holding these securities would have known exactly what they were investing in. But in many cases, at least it seems to me, that they didn't really know what they were investing in. So that was disappointing. So all of that is, you know, on the topic of accounting standards that contributed or made things worse.
Right, enabled all this stuff to be off balance sheet and for there to be less visibility because they were off balance sheet.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, the standards that were in place, FAS 140 and all of its interpretations, those standards had been crafted specifically to allow these kinds of transactions and were indeed heavily influenced by the institutions, banks, insurance companies, et cetera, that they had the greatest effect on.
And could you expand on that just a little bit more, Scott? How do these big banks heavily influence the accounting standards?
Well, that's a little harder for me to quite know. There's politics involved. There's lobbying involved. It didn't help that the regulators were singing from the same songbook. That is, the bank regulators wanted these standards to facilitate these activities as well, because they thought those activities made for healthier banks.
And just to be clear, because the terms politicking and lobbying inside the Beltway and with our commissioners has a meaning that they think that that's involves financial contributions to politicians. So is that what you're referring to, or are you referring to something different?
I think there were some financial contributions to politicians, but, you know, there are many ways to put pressure on the Accounting Standards Center. You know, obviously it starts with just simply comments at meetings and on proposals, but in when it comes to accounting standards that significantly affect the banking sector, you've often got banking regulators involved. And very often the bank regulators and the banks are pushing for similar things because they agree that those things would make for healthier banks. When the bank regulators get involved, that puts an added level of pressure on the FASB. And then there were plenty of letters from Congress over the years regarding securitization accounting. And if you look back through the history of those letters, before every crisis, the letters are all about, you know, you can't make changes that stop off-balance sheet accounting because that will hurt the banks. And if you hurt the banks, you hurt the economy. And then after the crisis, the letters change to, why did you have such crappy accounting standards? Fix this. And then the FASB tries to fix it. And then as they get close to finalizing the next fix, the next round of letters comes in saying, whoa, wait a minute, that's going to hurt banking activity. Slow down. It's been a cycle for the last 20 years or so, going back to the debate that led up to FAS 125. So, you know, I guess the politicking may not take the form of direct lobbying, as in sending lobbyists to hound the FASB, but the political pressure is there, the regulatory pressure is there, and the industry pressure is there.
Mm-hmm.
And the SEC at times has tried to act as a shield of the FASB so that they didn't face such pressure, and frankly at times has exacerbated the pressure. Not that it's relevant to this particular issue, but the FASB caved on stock option accounting in 1994 or so, basically because the SEC, you know, essentially told the FASB, "You're on your own. We ain't helping."
Okay.
You also asked about accounting standards that worked well during the crisis.
Sure.
And I actually do happen to think that the greater use of fair value accounting was helpful. It's interesting, many institutions were complaining about FAS 157 because it required them to record their investment securities at market prices that the banks really thought were inappropriately low. And I guess that they really did believe that the market had overreacted. They were complaining about FAS 157. Most of those institutions had voluntarily early adopted FAS 157 not too long before because they wanted to put more things at fair value, taking advantage of FAS 159's fair value option.
Right.
We went very quickly from a situation where institutions wanted and volunteered to record more things at FAS 157's definition of fair value very quickly to a situation where there were complaints about that very definition they had voluntarily early adopted.
Right, and that was kind of my reaction as well when I first started hearing these complaints that it was coming from financial institutions, because in my recollection it was the financial institutions who were the biggest supporters of 157.
Yes, I think it was more because they wanted
159.
And the two were tied.
And they wanted
To be fair, they probably weren't overly concerned during the development of 157 of exactly what the definition of fair value was. They just knew that when you coupled 159's fair value option, it was going to enable them to record things at fair value that they really thought would best reflect the way they managed the bank.
Right, and do you think that that's because they would prefer to just use 159 instead of perhaps having an historical cost measure and getting to at least the economics of a fair value measure via a derivative, that it's more efficient to use 159? Or do you think that it is how they run their book, so they want to have assets and liabilities at fair value? Is that why they're interested in 159?
I think it's a combination of all of those things. You know, there were some instances when hedging with a cash instrument would be better, but because you couldn't record the cash instrument at fair value that way, it was hard, you know, harder for them to get the accounting that they thought matched the economics. And also because some of them, there were parts of the business they really did run that way, mm-hmm. Tried to match the assets and liabilities off against each other. And tried to manage them as a group, and it made sense to at least use a current value measure rather than a historical measure. I think the financial crisis exposed that, you know, maybe the current value measure that the banks really would have liked is not the one that's described in FAS 157. They would have liked one that allowed them to exclude perhaps liquidity risks and things like that. Which FAS 157 obviously requires them to take into account. But I happen to think FAS 157 worked well because investors got the information that was most relevant to them. And they consistently sent the message that what we want to know is what you could sell it for today. And that's what 157 gave them.
Right.
And I think by and large, investors were well served by 157 and got information about changes in value quicker than they would have had we been using a different definition of fair value or had there been less adoption of fair value accounting by the affected institutions. So I thought 157 worked well. Other than temporary impairment standards...
Can I stop on 157? I just want to flesh out a couple of things with you and get your views on some specifics about 157.
Sure.
So one of the things... I've heard a lot about... 150, the evilness of 157, and that it exacerbated the crisis. Let me set that aside for just one moment. One other thing I've heard was 157 caused a need for a wholesale new valuation model compared to pre-157 for, let's assume, trading assets and liabilities. And I'm just curious whether you have any experience in kind of that transition or any knowledge of that transition to know whether that's really kind of a valid assertion. Because I would think you could use the same model you were using and you just change some of your assumptions. For example, exit price.
My understanding, and it is somewhat limited, I'll be honest, although I talk to a lot of people that work for financial institutions, they have more expertise in valuing these kinds of assets than I do, so they didn't directly consult me on a lot of this stuff. But my experience is that when they adopted 157, they generally felt that they were able to use their historical models. Some tweaks, but not much.
That's what I would expect, yeah.
When the crisis happened shortly thereafter, it became clear that at least in a stressed situation, those models didn't work to produce values that were consistent with 157's definition.
So
it's not clear to me what would have happened if they had been using fair value and there was a different definition in 157.
Right. So if we'd gone into the crisis and we'd had the stretch situation and we weren't on 157, perhaps they would have recognized as well that the models didn't work under stress situations.
Correct. And it really is unclear to me what would have happened in that situation.
Yeah, so the timing of 157 is kind of... It's kind of...
Fit and unfortunate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it causes some confusion about, is 157 a factor here somehow, or would some of the things that occurred have happened even though 157 had not been in play?
Yeah, and I think my sense is that where the model started breaking down when the crisis came was that the models were all built off what I'll call entity-specific assumptions, so the company's views about things.
Mm-hmm.
And 157, of course, very clearly says, no, it ain't your view that's important, it's the market's view.
Right.
And we ran into a situation with the crisis where very quickly the entity's views, the institution's views, and the market's views were clearly different.
Yeah, divergent, right.
And so it wasn't so much, I don't think, that the models didn't work. It's that 157 required you to use the market-based inputs, not your own view of the right inputs. And that, of course, gave you much lower numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess if we didn't have 157 and people concluded from that you could use entity-specific assumptions and didn't have to worry about the market, well, then maybe people wouldn't have had so many complaints and would have thought their old models worked just fine. But, I think we accountants have always believed that if there is a market price, that's the one you look to.
Right.
So I'm not sure what would have happened if 157 wasn't in place.
Okay. So the other thing I wanted to explore a little bit on 157 is this concept that your view is that the FAS 157 information provided investors with current information. Others would say the FAS 157 values, because they were developed in an unstable market, or reflected fire sale prices, and that information led to further fire sales. Regardless of which view you have, I wonder whether the FAS 157 values, which show up on financial statements that are produced periodically every 45 days, and when they come out, they can be 30 to 60 days stale.
Sure.
Whether the timing of the data being presented on financial statements, does that really have the ability to impact the pricing? And I'm only concerned now with those securities that are on the balance sheets as assets or liabilities of these financial institutions and not their individual stock. So, for example, if the financial statements for Citigroup or Bank of America comes out and you see the fair value of their assets and liabilities that are carried at fair value, that may impact your view of the stock price of Bank of America or Citigroup. But if you're trading or you hold, you're interested in the value of securities that they carry in their trading available for sale or held in maturity securities, RMBS, collateralized debt obligations, whatever it may be,
right.
I don't know as though the production of financial statements every 45 days that are 30 to 60 days stale impacts your decision about buying and selling and at what price those RMBS and CDOs and whatever other types of securities those institutions carry on their balance sheet.
Right.
And have you thought about that? Because everybody wants to point to 157 as causing all these fire sale transactions. And I'm just not sure that the timing of the information is really relevant to trades in the market.
I never bought that 157 could cause the fire sales. What I perceive was actually happening is that the fire sales were caused by situations where entities were required to increase liquidity. Maybe 157 is a factor because by reducing asset values to reflect 157's measurement requirements, you now had, by virtue of various regulatory measures, liquidity issues, or insufficient capital.
Right.
And one of the ways to deal with that is to sell securities, get cash, pay down debt, or in order to continue lending, you were going to have to either raise capital or get rid of other assets, and securities were the ones to get rid of. And therefore, 157 triggered the need for liquidity, and therefore you had to sell at whatever the market price was that day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was low. But I didn't think 157 caused the price to be low. But I do see how some could believe that 157 was part of the reason why you actually had to sell. I was on, when it was formed, the FASB's Valuation Resource Group, which was formed in part to deal with valuation issues in relation to accounting that came up because of the financial crisis. And at the very first meeting, somebody, member of that group who was not from a financial institution or insurance company or anybody else that would have a huge investment portfolio, he almost got angry during one of the discussions on one of these topics, and he said, "You're all sitting around here saying that the market prices are unreasonably low, and therefore you shouldn't have to mark to them. Why the hell aren't you buying then? If the market price is too low, buy."
Right, right, right.
"But you're all complaining about what you have to sell at."
Right.
You know, he said, clearly, that's inconsistent. And I think that's right. So I don't see 157 as having contributed to the fact that prices were low, but I think that the impact of gap accounting on regulatory measures created a need in some cases for these entities to sell things they wouldn't really have wanted to sell otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think was part of a vicious circle to some extent.
Right. So companies, now that I'm thinking about it, companies maybe they're running, they're managing their cash, their financial position on a daily basis. But they're also looking towards their quarter ends and knowing that they have regulatory capital measures that are measured as of those dates. And they clearly would be managing to make sure that they don't violate their regulatory capital. So as I look, for example,
right,
I'm sitting here in September 1st and I'm looking at September 30, I want to make sure that I have headroom to hit my regulatory capital, the standard, as well as where I internally want to be, and therefore I may sell off assets in order to delever to make sure that I hit the hurdle.
If that, if that is your most effective way to manage what you need to manage, you're going to do that.
Right. Okay.
And it's
not necessarily the number that shows up on the financials. It's the anticipation of the number that's going to show up on the financials, I think.
Well, and the anticipation of that number then being used in regulatory measures.
Right, exactly. Yep.
I think, although I haven't studied this in great detail, but my belief is that if there wasn't that explicit and direct link between the gap measurements and the regulatory measurements, we wouldn't have had such a strong negative reaction to FAS 157.
Right. So you see that the link of 157 is via capital.
That's my belief, yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and then other than temporary impairment is where you wanted to go next.
Yes, I do think that the financial crisis really showed that the other than temporary impairment standard was largely unworkable. Several of my partners and I eventually concluded that, other than temporary impairment for equity securities is simply a fool's errand. Because if you could actually predict that the equity markets are going to recover, well, you're in the wrong business. You ought to be just buying and selling stocks because you could make a lot of money because you know when stocks are going to go up. The fact that the other than temporary impairment rules for equity securities were unworkable, I think, was brought to me by a few consultations that I had. Clients called upset. Our auditors are telling us that these investments that we have in equity securities are clearly other than temporary impaired. Other than temporarily impaired, we got to run the loss through the income statement instead of OCI. And
so this would be available for sale equity securities,
right? And they were upset. They said, our auditors just don't understand. So I said, okay, what don't they understand? Well, the market always recovers. So even though these things are down 50%, we're going to hold them until the market recovers, and the market always recovers. Well, clearly the auditor in me looks at a 50% drop and says, only if you have some really strong evidence of recovery am I going to believe that that is a temporary loss.
Because of the depth.
Yes.
Right. Regardless of how long it's been, there's also a how long has it been like that factor.
Right, but, when you have a 50% loss, unless you can show me that the factors leading to the loss are clearly temporary in nature,
mm-hmm.
It's going to be hard to convince me that it's going to come back.
Right.
On the other hand, to my clients, the people managing these portfolios, it is absolutely a given that the market always comes back. And therefore, they're coming from a completely different viewpoint, which is essentially the loss is not other than temporary, unless there is clearly a problem in the underlying business.
I see. So all losses are temporary because things always go up and down. I can see that view.
And that just, that was one, big illustration to me that the other temporary impairment standard, particularly related to equity securities, is really unworkable. Mm-hmm. With regards to equity, it hasn't changed. And so we still have an unworkable standard. So the next time we have a severe market dip, we're going to be having the same arguments and conversations again unless the FASB's new financial impairment standard is out by then.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to debt securities, the other than temporary impairment standard was shown to have some weaknesses, which I actually think the FASB improved upon. And it issued the FSP dealing with other than temporary impairment of debt securities. And I think it was the crisis that illuminated the weakness in the other than temporary impairment model for debt securities and also drove the FASB to find a better solution. I happen to think the solution they came up with is needlessly cumbersome, but I do think it provides better information.
What? I'm just curious. How do you figure that it's needlessly cumbersome?
Because if there's a credit issue, you record the entire loss in the income statement and then reverse part of that loss to OCI. I'm a little confused. It's the way that you book the entries, and then there's a roll forward of the loss that has gone through the income statement. I just think that the standard was written in a way that, while it does give better information, it's harder to apply than it needed to be.
That's funny you should say that, because I have had to talk to a couple of companies to understand their disclosures in this area.
I think they're really hard to follow.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. I'm sure they were good intentions, but...
But what that standard did that I think is an improvement is it made the trigger for when you record an impairment through P&L more objective. If you think there's a credit problem.
Right.
Rather than if you think the loss is other than temporary, which is far more nebulous. So if you think there's a credit problem, you got a loss through the income statement. And then it also, by virtue of the way it recorded that loss, it broke the loss into two parts. One, the loss related to the credit problem, which goes through the income statement, and the other, the loss related to all other issues. So I think there's more information content there.
Yeah, let me pulse you a little bit on the model. Now, I haven't fully backtracked, but I think this concept of bifurcating a loss into credit and non-credit has existed previously, but perhaps not well understood or not broadly understood.
Right.
Do you have any history on that issue? Because I'm just curious, how much of a new model is this that was introduced? Or was this a model that existed but hadn't been broadly used in accounting standards before?
It's a model that had been talked about before. It had never been applied this broadly. We do have implicitly, loan loss reserves are that model, except only the credit loss gets recorded. You don't do anything with the market loss. So that we've always, at least, been able to differentiate a credit loss from another kind of loss. And so this just applies it to an area where it hadn't been applied before. It wasn't brand new, it wasn't revolutionary, but, it did bring in some new concepts to the evaluation of impairment of these kinds of securities.
Okay. I hadn't really thought of loan losses in that context, but you're right now that you say it that way. Okay, and did you have any thoughts on kind of the process that led up to the change in the other than temporary impairment model for debt securities?
Well, you know, obviously calling the FASB chairman before Congress and, you know, threatening him, do something in 3 weeks or else, is not my idea of a wonderful process. I got plenty of complaints about the process. However, I think the strength of the process also came out during that whole episode, in that the FASB showed it could do things quickly but intelligently. The comments on the proposals showed weaknesses in the proposals, which the FASB was able to react to. So the framework regarding accounting standard setting, you know, I think was shown to be valuable there. But, you know, I'm never one who likes political pressure being put on the Accounting Standards Center. On the other hand, I certainly understand why Congress believes that thinking about accounting standards is something they ought to do when it's important to the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really tell Congress shut up, because, I mean, the fact is they're elected to run the whole country, not the whole country except for accounting standards.
Okay.
So,
well put.
I would prefer that they presented their views in ways that didn't involve public threats.
Uh-huh.
You know, telling them to completely shut up about it, while sometimes I'd like to say that, I can't really in good faith say that Congress should, you know, simply take this piece of important economic structure and ignore it.
Right.
I can't tell them to do that.
Right. They have the right and the responsibility to be involved in all other areas. They can't have a hands-off approach to the FASB. I agree.
I mean, you know, I'd like them to apply a lighter touch. I'd like them to, be a little less combative in the way they deal with it. But, you know, if it's important to the country, I think Congress does have to pay attention.
Right. Well, arguably, if the FASB had gotten to where they got to, which seems as though you think it's the right place, if they had gotten there on a more timely basis, perhaps, and on their own, then Congress might not have had to intervene.
Certainly possible. And I think the FASB had already recognized they needed to do some work in those areas. Congress probably sped up that work, and may or may not have affected what the final product was.
Right.
Okay. So, again, I don't think it ended in a disaster. There was concern the proposal that the FASB put out 3 weeks after Congress issued his threats, I thought would have been horrible if those had been finalized as written. Because I thought the proposed FSBs really were going to gut a lot of the improvements that had been made to financial reporting with regards to 157. But the final FSBs fixed those shortcomings largely. And that's why I say the comment process appears to have worked, because the FASB was able to digest what they heard in the comment process and fix some of the problems.
Okay. Did you have other areas that... I have some other areas I would like to pulse you on, if you don't have any others that come to mind.
Oh, go ahead, wherever you'd like to go with it.
How about derivatives accounting? Well, let me give you a little bit of backdrop. So, derivatives are difficult for people to understand, and then if you couple that with the fact that many users of financial statements don't have the background to understand derivatives and don't have a background in accounting, then understanding the financial reporting for derivatives becomes even more complex than perhaps other areas of accounting.
Sure.
So curious whether you have any views about derivatives accounting, derivatives disclosure. The FASB has been did change their rules on disclosure during the crisis. But the accounting model currently is really unchanged since what was before the crisis. I know there's a new ED going to come out shortly. But just anything in the area of derivatives that you think is potentially an issue from reporting or disclosure or understandability in the financial statements?
Derivative accounting and disclosure has always been troublesome. I guess I didn't see those troubles being exacerbated during the crisis, though.
So, and I'm not saying they were. It's just that it's a topic that seems relevant to the crisis. There's a question of kind of what role did derivatives play in the crisis.
Well, so certainly the use of derivatives played a role. Credit default swaps obviously, you know, shifted the risk around and allowed more parties to take on risk than there actually was risk initially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because now you had, you know, the party holding the loans or the security, you had the risk of loss, and also the party that wrote a credit default swap had risk of loss. That would have all been fine if the credit default swaps were only written to the people that held securities.
So no nakeds.
We also have these lovely synthetic CDOs, like the ones Goldman Sachs is charged with having defrauded people regarding.
Right.
Now, where, you know, that there weren't enough risky mortgage securities to go around, so we sort of synthetically made more of them.
Right.
You know, such that the risk of loss was actually greater than the value of the securities, which was a rather curious development. So I guess I would, my view would be that derivatives certainly played a role in the crisis, but I don't see that the accounting for derivatives either helped or hurt.
Okay. So, a couple things to consider. Certainly if you asked the FASB whether derivatives are on or off balance sheet, they would say, oh, they're on balance sheet because they're measured at fair value and they're on the balance sheet. But then some people have asserted that we should go back to the forget the standard number, maybe 70 or 74, where we go back to the AICPA issues paper, which outlined that, for example, swaps should be treated as financings, which would bring more than just the fair value onto the balance sheet. It's not clear. Not clear whether people think the notionals should be on the balance sheet, or they would prefer that there not be any netting, so the gross cash flows be presented on the balance sheet and in the disclosures. And then the other angle is that if we have a problem with off-balance sheet structures, you know, sometimes derivatives are utilized as part of achieving the off-balance sheet accounting, and then your synthetic CDO, to me, is nothing more than a derivative in a special purpose entity.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So but again, I didn't think it was necessarily the accounting for that was the problem. It's, you know, kind of its existence.
Right.
But yeah, I think, you know, one place where you could see derivatives being an issue is, you know, the wonderful repo 105 and 108 transactions. You know, a repo is nothing more than selling a security and entering into a forward contract to buy it back. And, you know, everybody in the media, you know, seems to have taken the view that the accounting used by Lehman was obviously wrong. He shouldn't have been recorded as sales. I don't know whether they should be recorded as sales or not. Clearly some repos are sales and some are not, for accounting purposes. But one other way that you could slice that that issue is to say that, okay, maybe you had a real sale because the securities were sold free and clear to the buyer, could have done whatever he wanted with them, no restrictions. Maybe the way you fix the accounting, if you think it's bad, is you say that the forward contract to buy the security should be recorded gross. So then you'd have a situation where instead of having a derivative forward contract to buy treasury security, which would have very little fair value and therefore show up on the books at either a small asset or a small liability, you could have on the books right to receive treasury security at the current value of the treasury security, and a liability obligation to pay for treasury security, which would be recorded at the discounted amount that you're going to have to pay in a few days when the forward settles. There's certainly, I think, a divergence of views, and I think when you show somebody a fixed price forward, it's very easy for them to say, record that gross, because your interest now is in the changes in value of the thing you have committed to buy for a fixed dollar amount.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you're interested in. That's what you have the risks and rewards of. You don't have control of the security yet, but you're certainly subject to all the risks and rewards, so put it on the books. I can certainly understand that. On the other hand, if you show that same person a fair value forward, I'm going to buy this security in 1 month at whatever its value is on that date, well, they're probably not going to want to record that forward contract gross because they feel like you are not yet subject to the risks and rewards of the value of the underlying security, because changes in value are going to change the amount you pay for it in a month. So a risks and rewards person would say a fixed price forward, record gross. A fair value forward, record net. Now tell me what to do with a variable price forward. It doesn't change completely based on fair value, but it does change. Changes maybe only for interest rate risk, or only for credit risk, or only for liquidity risk. Well, now what do you do? Is that gross or is that net? So I think there are good faith debates and discussions to be held about this. But again, it's not my perception that derivative accounting helped or hurt in the crisis.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting you brought up the forward point, because for people who assert, for example, that either the gross cash flows or the notional amounts of derivatives should be presented on balance sheets, I wonder about these types of things like forwards and options. How do you deal with those? I mean, if it's
forwards, I think are easier to think about because it's going to happen eventually.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Options are a lot harder.
Yeah.
Even a deep in the money option, well, things can happen before that option terminates that would take the deep in the money option and make it not deep in the money by that point in time.
Right. In some regards, it feels like we're trying to change and vary the cutoff date for some of these transactions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. Anything else? We could have broad thoughts on causes of the crisis, and that would, if you have anything on those lines and you want to take the time, I'm happy to hear that too.
I'm not that smart as to the causes of the crisis. There are people that are far smarter than me haven't been able to figure it out, so I won't take a crack.
Uh-huh. Well, hopefully we'll get some insights over time.
Good.
Well, Scott, I thank you for your time, and then I may call you back at a later date to follow up if necessary. Your input's been very, very helpful.
By all means, feel free. I don't know if you are compiling written materials to be part of this, but several of the topics that we touched on today I had previously written about in my column in Compliance Week. I can send you copies of the relevant articles if it would help.
Oh, that would be great, because I don't subscribe, so that would be very helpful.
Yeah, I'll send you copies of a few columns that touch on some of these issues.
Okay, and if there's either now or at a later point, there's other materials that you think we should make sure we see, whether they're yours or someone else's, or if there's any individuals that you think would be important for us to talk to.
Okay.
That'd be helpful to know, too.
I assume you've got the usual suspects on the list, including FASB board members and folks like that?
Well, you would think we would, yes.
Well, if you need that recommendation, talk to Bob Hertz.
Okay.
But yeah, I don't know of anybody that would have insight on these accounting issues that wouldn't already be I think on your list.
Okay. All right. Well, Scott, hang on just 1 second. I just want to end the official call and end this recorder.
Okay.
Thanks again.